45 degrees Kenosha, 42 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That is the opening to one of the most eloquent and also intriguing works of the classical era by the great master Franz Joseph Haydn. It is his work known as The Seven Last Words of Christ. And this Friday evening, musicians of the Racine Symphony Orchestra are going to be playing this masterwork under the direction of their artistic director, Pascal Laurino. And we're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about this masterwork, which is not heard nearly as often as it deserves to be. So this is a rare treat indeed for people in southeastern Wisconsin to hear this work performed, a work which clearly meant a great deal to Franz Joseph Haydn, and a work which exists in a number of different arrangements by him. And the fact that he just returned to it again and again says something about the special place that it had in the composer's heart. And I'm so grateful to Pascal Laurino for joining me today for this portion of the morning show. Maestro Laurino, we welcome you back to the morning show.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you, Greg.
Glad we can have this conversation. So it's not every day that the Racine Symphony, or any symphony for that matter, is playing a performance on an occasion like Good Friday. Tell us a little bit about the conversations that took place in which this particular performance ultimately took shape in your plans for the season.
Well, this is really one of the seminal works of Franz Joseph Haydn, who at the time that he was commissioned to do this was the most famous, the most prominent composer in Europe. And so the chance to do this work on the day that it was commissioned for is extremely significant. I think one of the reasons that a piece of this importance probably doesn't hit the stages of the world as often as it perhaps might is because it's really difficult to establish the mood outside of a church setting where it's most appropriate. And we have in First Presbyterian Church an ideal setting for presenting this work as it was and supplemented. The piece was originally conceived to be done with meditations interspersed between each of the movements. And the pastor at First Presbyterian in Racine has been gracious enough to present those meditations between the movements, I think, which will give a sense of the flow and the solemnity of the music as it was originally intended.
I think before we have you talk about the circumstances under which this work was, I guess, commissioned is the proper term, it would probably be good for us to get out of the way a matter which will be very, very familiar to lots of our listeners, as it is to me. But I know that there are probably some listeners who might not be actually directly acquainted with this notion of the seven last words of Christ. Explain what we are talking about there before we start talking about this specific musical setting of those words.
Well, these are obviously not confined to just seven words, but utterances that Jesus made from the cross, which are referenced in the Bible and in the various books of the Bible. We have, for instance, in the first sonata, and each of the movements related to the depiction of these phrases are given a sonata number. There's an introduction to the work, and then sonata one is, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And these words in Latin, we know that he had those words in mind because he actually wrote underneath the notes the pater under the dotted rhythm that for that note and that descending line as it would be naturally spoken in Latin. So even though this was originally written as an instrumental work, it is directly connected to the Latin text, or by and large, the Latin text. Continuing the second sonata references the Jesus mentioning that on this day we will meet in paradise when he is with one of the fellow crucifixes just recognizing and forgiving him for his past indiscretions. At one point, Jesus mentions, I thirst. And this is set with very poignantly with the pizzicato, very secco, obviously a dry musical expression. Complementing this word, and perhaps one of the most vivid settings is the consummatus est, where consummatus est, those five syllables are given in unison, this descending line which the instruments play. Obviously, each of these movements is very linked with the text. Although, as I said, it was not originally written to be sung, but to create a meditative environment in which the pastor or the celebrant would comment, and then interspersed between these vocal meditations would be or sermons, the music would then be played in a darkened cathedral.
What can you tell us about the circumstances surrounding the commission? I mean, who was it that commissioned this from Haydn? And had Haydn ever been asked to compose something like this before? Or was this, in a sense, very much new ground that he was exploring?
This was new ground. I mean, Haydn was a devout Catholic, so clearly... And had written many masses and liturgical music during the course of his long and prodigious career. But this was a bit of a new one, which came from the other side of the world from where he was. He was at Esterhazy and in Hungary, the very eastern part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. And this commission came from southern Spain in Cadiz. So this gives an idea of how important a composer Haydn was by this time in his career. And a priest had commissioned the work at this oratorio di Santa Cueva. This they had restructured the liturgical space, the church, and they wanted a piece of music to reflect, obviously, the new trappings, and turn to Haydn on this most poignant occasion, Good Friday, to present the work setting the last seven words of Christ. It was a challenge for Haydn, who was so versed at being able to write almost anything on call. He was so facile at this kind of thing, but was a bit flummoxed at how to present a work that would hold interest for an audience that was going to obviously be seven meditative pieces with an introduction making it eight, you know, how to hold it together. And I think one of the things that's extraordinary about the setting and may not be immediately obvious to maybe most composers taxed with this job is that he writes some of them in a major key. Even though it is slow, it shows a hope or promise. And rather than, you know, seven or eight movements all set in minor, so there's a great deal of hope and above all love. And this expression on Good Friday is the good part of Good Friday. This is not only about a horrific execution, but it is a testament to the hope that this moment in time brought to mankind, and the influence of that being manifested in this, in the last movement of the work, this earthquake, which is so stark in contrast with all of the other movements.
Hmm. We're speaking with Maestro Pascal Larino, Artistic Director of the Racine Symphony Orchestra, and musicians of the Racine Symphony will be playing this Friday night a performance of Franz Josef Haydn's The Seven Last Words of Christ, one of his most noteworthy masterworks. I don't remember if we've said yet, when was it that this work in its original form was composed? At what point in Haydn's long life and career?
It was composed in 1786, and so this Haydn was born in 1732. So obviously he was in very much in his mature years. By this time he had gotten outside of Esterhazy and presented concerts in Paris and about to present his big oratorios in London, the Creation and the Seasons. Yes, he was artistically running on all cylinders at this point. And to apply himself, it's such a spiritually rich piece for a man that actually prefaced almost all of the works that he wrote. He would write on the first page to the glory of God, and then at the end when he finished, he would write thanks be to God. So clearly he was connected in not only this work, but this is probably his, as they say in Italian, capolavoro, is the epitome of what he could express as an artist, but also as a man.
Right. And it's so interesting. I mean, all of that, of course, is true. This spoke deeply to him and was reflective of his own deep and sincere religious faith. And yet, as you've already mentioned, and as I remember reading, this was also a task with which he struggled. I I think it was in a letter he wrote some years later talking about the writing of this, and where Haydn himself said, "It was no easy task to compose seven adagios lasting 10 minutes each." I mean, for as much as this was an opportunity that spoke deeply to him, it was also daunting on a couple of different levels. And I find that in and of itself so intriguing. It's one thing when somebody finds something daunting because it's not quite the right fit, or it's maybe you takes you kind of on alien terrain. That's not what made this daunting for Franz Joseph Haydn.
Indeed, indeed, it was really a labor of love, but he felt a great deal of responsibility, but applied every element of his craft to, I think, really one of Western music's greatest statements.
One of the things we, I think, should talk about is the way in which Haydn himself recast this work on a couple of different occasions. That is, it exists in several different versions. And I think it would be interesting if you would kind of outline that for us and then clarify the version, or the modified version, which the Racine Symphony is going to be presenting Friday night.
Yes, when Haydn received the original commission, it was for a full classical orchestra with strings, winds, and some brass, timpani. And in that form, obviously, it had some limited application to being done, and it was soon very much sought after piece to be done in other church settings. So the resources of a string quartet seemed to be more within the space parameters and also the budgets of many congregations. So the string quartet version was formulated. And then a number of years later, Haydn heard actually a version of his of this seven last words, which he had written as an instrumental piece, but somebody had written a choral version of the piece. And Haydn, upon listening to it, thought that he could come up with a better choral version himself. Who better to do it than Haydn? So he wrote an oratorio version with soloists and chorus and full orchestra again, this being the largest manifestations of the piece. Of course, as many works were done at the time, there was also a solo piano version written of it. And yes, given its popularity, it's taken many different manifestations over the course of time, and even on Friday, we're doing our own version, which is to use the string quartet version that Haydn wrote, which includes all of the notes that he wrote in the original version, and we've added to that timpani for the thing, and we've supplemented the string quartet to a full string section, so it gives it a little bit richer texture, which I think will work wonderfully in the acoustic at first press.
Very good. I wonder if you want to outline for us a couple of other highlights from this work to which you want to really draw our listeners' attention.
It's almost difficult to find one or a few moments. Every time I'm studying this work, it gets me in that reflective mood, and this is exactly what Haydn was looking for. He was, in fact, unencumbered from actually hearing a singer or in a presentational way giving this text. Hearing it in an instrumental setting, which was originally set for, is a great way to stay in this mind space and thinking in a prayerful way about this poignant moment in liturgical history. The other moments, certainly when he is talking to his mother, "Mother, behold your son." This again is given such it is done with such tenderness that one can only feel this overwhelming sense of love, and it certainly is among my favorite moments of the work. And of course, not to bring a spoiler alert to the the whole proceedings, but this day when Christ finally dies, the earth is was said to have shaken, and we have an earthquake. And for about a minute and a half to 2 minutes, the most frenetic music that Haydn ever created, that was created in the classical period, is brought in bold relief and captivating such a meditative and serene experience. This is a jolting, and I think speaks to maybe the significance of Christ's death on the world. And so this is really a full it's a full-bodied emotional experience.
Is this a work that you've had the opportunity to conduct before this?
Actually, I have to say, Greg, that I've never conducted it, and as a player of over 50 years, I've never played it because I've never found the absolutely the right circumstance to do it. It is a work that really properly should be done on Good Friday, and the combination of circumstances, availability of venue, availability of a minister, a preacher to be able to have these meditations in between, and Pastor Darren will be doing that at First Pres for us. This is everything aligned at this moment to present really the work as it should be. I didn't want to just do it as a concert piece. I didn't want to extract, for as beautiful as any one of the movements are, to just do a single movement out of context. Here, to do this piece in context was, I think, a very, very significant thing for us to do. The Recine Symphony has never done it, nor have I. And so we are going to experience this together for the first time, and I'm sure it would be a very poignant experience for us all.
Right. And so, I mean, we sometimes bandy about the phrase, you know, this is going to be a rare treat, but this, I should think, exceptionally so. And in a sense, a rare treat for you professionally as the conductor, and I assume for nearly all, if not every one of the musicians who will be playing Friday night as well. I suspect that this is also a first for them, and maybe a first and a last, because, as you say, it is not often that all of the circumstances align where it makes sense and is right to present this beautiful work by Franz Josef Haydn. Remind our listeners about exactly when and where this concert is going to be occurring, and what people should do if they are interested in tickets.
Obviously, on the Racine Symphony webpage, details of the concert and acquiring tickets can be found. The concert itself is on Good Friday, April 7th, at First Presbyterian Church at 7:30.
Very good. Maestro Pascal Lorino, the artistic director of the Racine Symphony Orchestra, thank you for being part of today's morning show, and thank you for helping to make possible this performance of this marvelous work by Franz Josef Haydn.
Thank you so much, Greg. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're listening back to an archival interview that I recorded some years ago with Raghavan Iyer, Indian-born chef and author and a world-renowned expert on curries. Raghavan Iyer was born in 1961 in India, raised in Mumbai, but moved to the United States in the early 1980s to study hospitality at a couple of different Midwestern universities. Mr. Iyer eventually became a chef and then a cookbook author. His first book, published more than 20 years ago, was Betty Crocker's Indian Home Cooking, which introduced many Americans to the beauty of Indian cuisine. I was scheduled to interview Mr. Iyer on the 1st of March about his most recent book, On the Curry Trail, Chasing the Flavor That Seduced the World, a lovely book that traces the diaspora of curries from out of India and Pakistan to Africa, Europe, and the Americas, giving the reader an idea of the astonishing variation of curry cuisine found all over the world. Sadly, Mr. Iyer was forced to cancel our interview because of illness, and 30 days later, he was gone. I'm very thankful that I had the opportunity to interview Mr. Iyer back in 2008 about one of his previous books, and I want to share that interview now from the Morning Show archives in his memory. Well, we are going to have a delicious few minutes now speaking with an award-winning chef and a chef and cooking teacher by the name of Raghavan Iyer. And Raghavan Iyer is responsible for a wonderful new book called 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. And in this book, we learn exactly what the term curry means. And it means actually different things in different places. But of course, it means more than anything, a rich, wonderful array of dishes that come to the world from the colorful nation of India. And Raghavan Iyer comes at this task with a lot of expertise, and has won awards as a cooking teacher. Is also the author of the Betty Crocker Indian Home Cooking book, and this latest book is really a beautiful work of art with all kinds of recipes and all kinds of fascinating information about curries. 660 Curries is published by Workman Publishing, and Raghavan Iyer, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Greg.
You know, it's interesting. It's not the book we're specifically talking about today, but I keep finding my eyes drawn back to the title, Betty Crocker's Indian Home Cooking. I mean, in a sense, that really shows us something about how much the world has changed, the culinary world. That, I mean, 50 years ago, the thought of a Betty Crocker book concerning itself with Indian cuisine would be just unthinkable. And now it obviously exists, and we are just part of this global village in which we are starting to really understand and appreciate and enjoy one another's foods.
Perfect time to really appreciate the diversity and the variety that you find in the world of Indian curries. And I think, you know, people always ask me, you know, 660 curries, is there more? And I said, yes, there is, and I got tired after 660. But I think, you know, when you think about the world of Indian curries, I always say it's interesting because curry itself is a word that is not spoken in any of the 23 languages in India. We have words that sound similar to curry, and they all are words that signify dishes that have a sauce or a gravy to it. So when it comes to Indian curries, I always say associate the four S's with it. They're saucy, they're spicy, they're simple, and they're sensational. Mm-hmm. Sort of like me.
I think one thing that's interesting is the image you use of being a chemist. Uh-huh. And that comes up quite a lot in the pages of this book in describing the way you cook and even the process of trying to get a tight handle on the term curry itself. I mean, mm-hmm. in a sense for you, this has been a bit of a scientific undertaking as well.
It has been, and I think, you know, as a cooking teacher of 18 years, I always said the best tool I can give my students is to empower them with with what curries are all about, and I wanted to teach them and give them the tools that let it happen. And it's all about building that saucy repertoire. And, you know, to give you an example, you know, when you think about, we are entering really grilling season here shortly, and I always say a perfect thing to do is to, if you take, if you love lamb, you could take lamb chops from the rib rack, and you can slice it, and oftentimes I would say you could take a little bit of a ginger and garlic and rub it over the lamb and then grill it on an outdoor grill. It's not a curry at this point in time, but you bring, you take a little skillet and then drizzle a little bit of oil and throw in some cumin seeds in that hot oil, which will sizzle in about 5 or 10 seconds. Throw in a little bit of red onions and add some tomatoes to that with some fresh herbs like cilantro and chilies, a touch of salt, and then all of a sudden you've got the sauce component that you're going to drape over the grilled lamb chops, and you have an incredibly savory, delicious, layered dish within 30 minutes start to finish.
Let me reread the definition, which I think you gave sort of a condensed version of at the top of the interview. You define a curry as any dish that consists of meat, fish, poultry, legumes, vegetable, or fruits simmered in or covered with a sauce, gravy, or other liquid that is redolent of spices and or herbs. I guess that last part is especially crucial, because if you leave that out, then something like hamburger helper almost qualifies as a curry. But of course, you know, hamburger helper or anything like it that comes out of a box does not give us that wonderful array of spices and herbs that you say are really central to the cuisine of curries.
Absolutely. And I've always said, you know, herbs and spices are the backbone to Indian curries, even though there are many curries in India that don't have any spices in it, but just fresh herbs, for instance. There's a wonderful eggplant dish that comes to mind. The vegetable curry chapter alone has over 200 recipes in it. And I have a really nice eggplant that I grill or broil, char the skin out, and then you could take the pulp and mash it. And then I have actually stir-fried that with a little bit of oil or clarified butter and throw in three ingredients to flavor it, fresh garlic, red chilies, and salt. And that's it. And it's an incredibly layered dish. And oftentimes I will take that and lather that onto pieces of crusty crostinis, and then you could do a great appetizer out of it and serve that with what Indians do. You serve it with scotch. But it is a wonderful way to explore the world of curry.
By the way, help us understand, I guess, a misconception. That is, a lot of people assume that if you're talking about a dish with the name curry, then it's obviously something in which you've poured a bunch of curry powder in.
Yes.
And in fact, that isn't really directly the case at all. What does curry powder have to do with this whole cuisine? Is it just one of many possible elements?
No, actually, curry powder is I've always said no self-respecting Indian home kitchen has curry powders in it. Curry powders are non-existent in the Indian home kitchens. The concept of a curry powder originated with the English being in India in the early 16th century, and they loved the flavors of some of the sauces they've tried, and they captured that into a bottle called curry powders, and they have done an amazing job of marketing that to the rest of the world. I've always said curry is never added, it just is. I think all of a sudden when you think about it in that context, you realize that there's such a depth to the layers of curries in Indian kitchens.
So curry powder, in a sense, is a shortcut and not a very good shortcut at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it in a sense, it is the antithesis of what your book is all about, which is
Yes. This
almost limitless array of spices and herbs that make all of this so wonderful.
Absolutely, and I think you've hit the nail on the head with that. When you use curry powders, you sort of pigeonhole your flavors, and you really don't have that remarkable array of flavors you get. I talk about, in the spice chapter, I talk about how we can extract 8 flavors from a given spice. And these are all distinct flavors that are poles apart. And then you take that concept and multiply that by the hundreds of spices we use, you've sort of taken a peek into the world of Indian curry. So it is, it's a groundbreaking concept, and I think a lot of people don't realize the depth of Indian curry. 660 curries is a lot, and I've always said there's actually, you know, I wanted to do 1,001 curries. And when you think about it in that context, I think it opens up a whole new world.
Sure. We're talking with Raghavan Iyer about his book, 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. Just a let's go with spices for a moment, because this is an especially interesting chapter in the book. You devote a whole chapter to spices, spice blends and pastes. One of your most basic bits of advice, and we've probably received this advice from others, but you're very persuasive in saying how important it is that we buy our spices in their whole forms. Explain, first of all, what you mean by that and why that is so crucially important.
Sure. I think, you know, when I talk about buying spices in the whole seed form, to give an example, even if you take cumin seeds, you know, which everybody is so familiar with, when you buy spices, like, first of all, whole spices will keep for quite a while. I would say at least even a couple of years outside the refrigerator in an airtight container. Because why I talk about buying whole spices is, as I alluded to earlier, we can extract 8 flavors from a given spice. To run through very quickly, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what some of those flavors are. When you use a spice as is in the whole seed form, you get one flavor. When they're ground raw, you get a second flavor. When they're dry toasted, left in the seed form, you get a third flavor. When they're ground after it has been dry toasted, you get a fourth flavor. When they're sauteed in some kind of a fat, left in the seed form, you get flavor number 5. When they're ground after they've been sauteed, you get flavor number 6. When they're soaked in some kind of a liquid used in the seed form, you get flavor number 7. And then when they're ground after they've been soaked in a liquid, you get flavor number 8. And then keep in mind that the kind of liquid you use will change the flavor of the spice. And so they just get deeper and deeper. And that's one of the reasons why I think buying whole spices and teasing all these different flavors out of it makes it so fascinating.
And this chapter of the book not only then gives advice on how to store whole spices and various ways to grind them, but then you have what really appear to be recipes for spices, for that is, for spice blends, for putting different spices together in absolutely wonderful ways.
And I think, you know, oftentimes when you start to cook from the book and you'll make all these curries, you will find yourself coming back to the spice blend and paste chapter to put together some of the blends. And keep in mind, these blends, each and every blend, I would say 99% of them will take you 5 minutes or less to put together. And some of these dry blends will keep for 2 to 3 months outside the refrigerator. So all of a sudden, when you do it one time, 5 minutes or less, you will have it on hand every time you want to do something very quickly. And I also talk about, in that chapter, I give you sort of the top 5 or top 7 blends and pastes you can put together that will cover, let's say, 60 to 70% of the book. So it is a very efficient way of doing it. And also, it perks up your everyday fare within minutes. I also have a chapter on what I call curry cohorts that are designed to complement the flavors of curries, everything from rice dishes to flatbread, to condiments and pickles and yogurt accompaniments that enhance the eating experience of curry. So it is a complete way to, I've always said 660 curries is one curry a day for 2 years with time off for holidays.
Very good. One thing that's intriguing in the body of the book, where you have all kinds of different recipes, many of them your own, but some from others, is that almost without exception, I think, when a recipe is from someone in your life, you tell us a little bit about them. You tell us their name and often what they do for a living. And I don't remember ever seeing that before in a cookbook. And I think it's such a wonderful choice you've made.
Well, thank you. And I think, you know, oftentimes you alluded to the fact that we live in a global market now. And I think food is the medium that connects cultures and people. And when you start to personalize a dish that could be exotic sounding and very foreign, but then you personalize it and then attach a name and a character and a little story to go with it, I think that becomes very universal all of a sudden, and it is no longer foreign and strange. And I always wanted to bridge cultures and bridge gaps, and I think talking a little bit about where the recipe comes from, who provided it, a little bit about their life, I think makes it much more in your backyard sort of a concept. And that's really one of the things I wanted to do in this book. I'm glad you saw that and you appreciated it. And I hope that a lot of your listeners would feel the same way.
I was intrigued to find mention, particularly in the poultry chapter, but I'm sure in other sections as well, mention of the Indian wok, W-O-K. Is that significantly different from the wok that we know from other cultures and cuisines?
Yes. We actually, our Indian woks are called kadhai. And you keep in mind that our kadhais have been in existence for, I would say, over 5,000 years, because India is a country that is at least 6,000 years old. Our woks are very, they're very similar to actually some of the Japanese-style woks. They have a much more of a rounded bottom, our woks in India don't have handles. And we have pliers. They look like pliers or tongs. And we hold on to our woks, and we do our stir-frying and our simmering and so on. And they can range. Most of our woks tend to be actually of cast iron. There are some woks that are done with clay. There are some woks that are done with anodized metals. And so the transfer and the retaining of heat is really quite optimal. So they do range, and you get some phenomenally delicious flavors out of them. Hmm. We use our woks not only for stir-frying, but in fact, many of our curries that often require simmering and stewing, the woks work really well, especially when they're well-seasoned. I do end up using, I do have quite a wonderful array of woks, some of which I brought back from India on numerous trips that I do, food and cultural tours to India. So when I come back with some different kinds of utensils and woks, and I just I love how the curries do have such interesting flavors and techniques that you can create
right
in those vessels.
There's a whole chapter devoted to legume curries, another to beef and pork and lamb, another to seafood, another to poultry, another to vegetable curries. You say the Indian people are particularly masterful when it comes to evoking wonderful flavors from the world of vegetables. So
yeah,
there's going to be something for just about everybody in the pages of this book. I'm just curious, for those of us who really only know Indian cuisine from having maybe visited an Indian restaurant, I'm prompted to ask this question because I recently interviewed the author of a book about Chinese restaurants, who emphatically made the point that your typical Chinese restaurant is serving food that is really not Chinese at all, at least in terms of the kind of food that people in China eat. What about Indian restaurants here in the United States? When we go to one, are we at all experiencing what the good people of India eat?
More often than not, I think you are not experiencing the gamut of flavors and textures. Most of the Indian restaurants in the Western world feature a very small part of Northwestern Indian cooking, the cooking of Punjab and the cooking of the Mughal court. The Mughals had a very strong influence in Indian cooking and culture and architecture in northern India, and they were the rulers just prior to the British taking over. And so you see a small slice of that represented in Indian restaurants and dishes like tandoori chicken or naan or some of the four limited curries that you find in these restaurants. And so the flavors are much more limited, and it doesn't show the extent and the full-bodied nature of some of the saucy repertoires you find back in India. And so very reluctantly, I say, they show a very small slice of that region. And, if you've never had Indian food, I'd say a great place to start would be at an Indian restaurant, just so you get accustomed to something. But keep in mind, as a cooking teacher of 18 years, I've had students that keep coming back to me and said, "You have spoiled Indian restaurants for us because the foods are, when I cook Indian food at home, it just takes it from level 1 to level 99 in a matter of minutes." And I think that, to me, shows really the beauty and the depth of working with some of the herbs and spices that form our spicy repertoire.
The book, again, is called 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. All kinds of wonderful information and illustrations, a plethora of terrific, fascinating recipes, and all kinds of little sidelight facts about cuisine in India, how someone in India sits down and eats a meal, backup information about some of these interesting foods. It's an absolutely fascinating book, and it's published by Workman, and it's author Raghavan Iyer. Raghavan Iyer, I enjoyed this book so much. I look forward to the challenge of using it, and I so enjoyed talking with you about it. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you so much, Greg, for letting me come into your studios and into all your listeners' homes, and I really wish that people would get into it and adopt the whole concept of Indian curry on a daily basis.
Raghavan Iyer, we thank you again.
Thanks again, Greg.
The preceding interview with Raghavan Iyer was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2008. Mr. Iyer passed away on March 31st at the age of 61. He died of cancer. His most recent book is titled On the Curry Trail, Chasing the Flavor That Seduced the World in 50 Recipes. The book is published by Workman Publishing. I highly recommend it. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be spending some time with best-selling author Tom Clavin talking about his latest book, which is called Follow Me to Hell, McNally's Texas Rangers and the Rise of Frontier Justice. Today is going to be a cloudy, windy, and warm day. Patchy fog and rain showers on and off all day long with a high temperature of 53 degrees. Cloudy overnight, windy and rainy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, cloudy in the morning, sunshine by the afternoon. At some point during the day, a 40% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high all the way up to 69 degrees.
We should have sunshine then the rest of the week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And actually, by the weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, the forecast is for sunny skies and high temperatures in the low to mid-60s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.